Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from The Grave Talks. If you're liking this program, I invite you to become a grave keeper. That is a supporter of this program. You are the folks who will financially allow this show to continue going forward. $5 a month gets you access to advanced episodes of the show as I create them. Typically 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes even more episodes in advance, available exclusively for our grave keeper members. Plus, exclusive interview segments that are not going to be available to the public, only to gravekeepers. Typically an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes of interview time with future guests of our show going forward. It's exclusive content, it's advanced content, and it's only for gravekeepers who are helping to keep the show on the air. It takes a tremendous amount of time every single week for me to put this show together, get it up, get it on the air, have it hosted, bandwidth, all of that. And I love doing it, but we do need to make sure it's financially viable, in at least to support the costs of running this thing. So if you like the show, please consider becoming a gravekeeper through our website, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month, get advanced access and exclusive content as well to keep this show on the air. Thank you for your support. I hope you enjoy it just as much as I do. Check it out, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. And thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the Haunted Exchange Hotel. The Exchange Hotel in Pennsylvania is home to many spirits. Originally constructed as an opulent hotel along a rail line, it would soon find its rooms converted to a triage center during the war. More than 70,000 soldiers would pass through the rooms of the Exchange Hotel during the Civil War. Roughly 1% would take their last breath at the hotel. This means nearly 700 soldiers would die at the Exchange Hotel. After the war, it was converted back into a hotel that would almost immediately begin being known as the haunted location in town. Murder, suicide, and other dark events would grace its steps before eventually being shuttered in the 1970s as tourism died down. This is the story of the Haunted Exchange Hotel, shared by Christy Summer of Soul Sisters Paranormal.
All right. Well, the Exchange Hotel is located in Gordonsville, Virginia, and that's about an hour northwest of Richmond, Virginia, about 2 hours south of D.C. And essentially, it was a very small, quaint town. And even if you go there today, it really looks like you're stepping back into history. In the 1940s, the railroad came into Gordonsville, and it essentially acted as an economic catalyst for the region. And because those goods and services were now able to get into that quaint town, it really began to grow and thrive. And then in about the in 1854, three railroad lines, the Orange, the Alexander, and the largest of which was the Virginia Central Line, actually converged in Gordonsville, which meant that at the time, goods and services could come from the north, south, east, and the west. So it was really an exchange spot for people and goods in the region. And so because of that, they needed a location where those passengers that would come and get off one rail line could wait in comfort for the other trains to come in, for the next train to come in. So what they did is they built, several people in the area started building taverns and restaurants and hotels in the area so these people could have that luxury spot to wait for their next train. So it essentially became an exchange location. Let's see, 1859, there was a tavern that was located on the property that is now the Exchange Hotel. And it was just a tavern, but it ended up burning down. And so the owner of that property decided that he wanted to build a large, opulent hotel where people could actually spend the night. So he built this hotel. It was three stories. And it was very opulent for the time. It had 8 large guest rooms that had high ceilings, had large windows, had large verandas that passengers could sit and wait for their next train, or they actually had a small restaurant where you could have food. So it was really a hub of the community there in Gordonsville. And so after when the Civil War started around 1860, in 1861, Virginia seceded from the Union, and troops started departing from the town of Gordonsville via these train stations. So they would go to Harper's Ferry and some of those other locations to report for duty. And so the railroad lines became a transit line for soldiers and munitions rather than goods and services at that point. So you had all of these troops that were coming in, mostly from the Confederates, that were coming in and using this as a transit location to get to various battlefields. Then in 1862, the military came in and they took over this hotel and they used it as a hospital, mostly a triage hospital for those troops. It was called the Gordonsville Receiving Hospital. So these troops would come in via those train lines again, and now these troops are wounded, they're dying, they have various diseases. So the hospital was, like I said, a triage hospital where they would very quickly treat whatever the ailments was, wherever the wounds were, mostly through amputations, and a lot through, just patching up and such. And then they would stick them outside after they were triaged. They would stick them outside and people would pick them up and put them back on the train lines to go to larger hospitals like Richmond or Charlottesville or something like that. So while a lot of soldiers came through that hospital, about 70,000 actually, 70,000 troops went through that hospital in its time of operation between 1862 and 1865. Only about 1% of them actually died there. So there was roughly 660 Confederate troops that died there and about 23 Union soldiers that died there because they did accept some Union troops as well.
So it's interesting to think, what 1% sounds like a small number, but then you take 1% of 70,000. It's like, okay, 600 some people dying in one location that was not a traditional hospital is a pretty high number.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So when you think about it, and because those men were dying and there's still troops coming in to be triaged, mm-hmm. they didn't have anything to do with them. So what they did is they actually had a field right behind the hospital where they just dug a big hole and started plopping these troops in, their bodies. So they would essentially just put these bodies in there and bury them. And then the next guy that died, they just put him on top of him and bury him. And so that continued until about, like I said, until the hospital was closed in 1865. So later, those men that were buried they were interred at a nearby cemetery. But up until that time, when they could get back to that, there were just about 700 men. Their bodies were just laying out there behind this field, behind the hospital in this field. And so after the hospital closed in 1865. And during the Reconstruction, it was returned to a hotel, but it was also used as an education center for free slaves. So those that were freed from the Civil War, they needed a place to be educated, and so this hotel that was a hospital was now turned back into a hotel and an education center. It did function as a hotel until about 1970, and then the tourism began to decline in the area. So then it was bought by the city of Gordonsville and is now the Exchange Hotel and Civil War Museum. So it does have a long and storied history. And because of that, there is a lot of reports of paranormal activity, both in the hotel itself and also in what's called the Summer Kitchen, which is a small outbuilding that sits adjacent to the hotel.
Let's talk for a moment about the atmosphere in the town when the war is going on and the people, mm-hmm. the people of the Gordonsville area they're seeing what was once this opulent hotel, this beautiful place. Now it's this, it's completely upended, as is most of the country at that moment in time. So it's not mm-hmm. like, oh, the hotel just has gone to hell. Like everything is not in the greatest shape and they're in the middle of a war. But I mean, that in itself, I mean, the emotion of just seeing everything dramatically change from a complete 180 on what it was to something else. I mean, what's the atmosphere in the town like as this hospital ends up seeing 70,000 plus soldiers come through during the war?
Well, absolutely. So, there is that feeling of, one, pride in their soldiers that have gone off to war to fight, but then also you've got the realization that our guys are coming back and they're dying. Not just our guys from Gordonsville, but from all of the Confederate regiments that are out there. So, you know, you have people that are volunteering to be nurses. You have people that are actually being, you know, pressed into service as runners or nurses or essentially assistant personnel to help these doctors that have come to do all of this triage. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, there are reports of these women that were pressed into service as nurses that couldn't handle it, and they ended up committing suicide. There's 4 reports of nurses that actually killed themselves because they couldn't handle what they were seeing. There is a report of a young child in his early teens that, you know, the report is that he was kind of pressed into service to be a runner boy to do all these errands, and he couldn't handle it either. So he ended up hanging himself as well. So, you know, there is that very morbid feeling that is going on through the town at this time, just because they are seeing that death. And again, there's nothing that they really can do because it is moving so quickly because of the train lines. And again, that's why they're having to just throw these men that are dying into the field in the back, as well as moving them from the hospital back onto the trains to go to those larger hospitals.
Sure. Being that it did offer services and care to Union soldiers as well, you can make your assumptions. This was primarily a Confederate hospital, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So majority of them, but they weren't turning away any of those Union troops that came in, albeit it was a smaller number.
They're not turning them away, but one has to guess, are they getting as good of care for the day as their own would have been getting?
One would hope, yes.
One would hope, but one would wonder as well, just to seeing as their ambivalence for the bodies once they had, you know, created a mass grave out back. You'd have to wonder if that is, you know, I don't know. I mean, just speaking to human nature of the time, and one would hope. I'm sure there were some that did, and I would have to wonder if there were some that did not. And I wonder if any of that plays into any of this as well, in terms of the haunting of not getting adequate care, the disposal of the bodies in the way that they did, and any sort of anger or angst that still is in existence because of that. That's one of those angles that I kind of wonder about with this.
Oh, sure. You know, there could be absolutely anger and resentment toward, you know, inequality of care. And, you know, again, I would hope that those professional doctors that came in would treat everybody equally, but you just never know.
Sure.
You know, I haven't found anything in my research that would say that they were treated inferior.
Sure.
But you never know.
Probably not something that would be necessarily documented either. And no one is
right.
around anymore to be like, yeah, my Uncle Bernie, he saw them come in there and, you know, they ashed their cigars out. You know, nothing like that. That doesn't exist. So very interesting. Obviously, such a structure that sees all the way up to the war, through the war, it has seen a lot. Structures that don't go through wars, that are simply hotels, that are meeting places, that are on the rail lines, that see a lot of coming and going, and families, you know, coming and seeing each other and separating and all that. There's a lot of emotions just fraught with that. But then you add the war into it, and this place opens back up as a hotel after the war. You may have mentioned it earlier. How far after the war did it become a hotel once again? How many years span was that before they said, hey, we're open for business, welcome to the Days Inn?
It really functioned, from what I can tell, up until about the 1970s. And then, you know, tourism started to wane a little bit, and, you know, there's quicker way of moving goods and services rather than the trains. So it really did start to decline at that point. And now, like I said, it does function as the Exchange Hotel and Civil War Museum. And it's fascinating because when you walk into it, I mean, you see this opulent hotel because it has been very well maintained, and you just kind of picture yourself going back in time, you know, sitting on the veranda, watching the trains go by, looking out across the mountains, and you can see where it'd be a location that people would go to actually relax and, you know, spend a little bit of money to stay in this type of hotel. hotel. The rooms are grand. They've got, you know, large 10 to 12 foot ceilings. The hallways are wide. There's wide staircases. So it's a beautiful hotel for what it is. But then you go into the rooms, and some of the rooms are now decorated, if you will, with images from the Civil War. So you've got pictures of guys without legs, or, you know, guys without arms, or people laying on an operating table. They actually have a surgery table there that was a surgery table used during the time. It's an actual surgery table, and according to the proprietor there, it still has blood on it. So there's a lot of reminders of that. So you kind of walk in and you see the grandeur of this hotel to begin with, and then you start walking through the rooms and you're like, wow, you know, this is a place where blood was spilled. So you can see why there would be that heaviness, outside of the paranormal reports, just that heaviness that you know what this room was used for and what this establishment was used for.
Sure. Is it, I know you said it's a museum. Is it a place you can still stay, or is this just for example purposes? This is what the rooms looked like. These are example rooms.
No, you can't stay there any longer. You can go take a day tour, as well as do private paranormal investigations, which is what we did.
Okay. Let's go back further, not to just today, but let's go back to that massive time window, because we're talking, what, roughly 100 years or so of it operating as a hotel after the war?
Correct.
Okay. Yep. So let's go back to, what was the hotel like when it became an operational hotel again after the war? Was it up to a grand standard, or was it just kind of another place to stay along the path?
From what I can tell, it did return to that grand standard. You know, they, like I said, the ceilings are high, the hallways are wide, the veranda is huge. You can sit out there in rocking chairs. And they really tried to, you know, bring that back, because, I mean, the entire country was under a reconstruction period at the time. And I think some people wanted to, well, a lot of people wanted to kind of get back to some normalcy, if you will. And I think the Exchange Hotel tried to provide that. And plus, you know, you still got these major rail systems that are converging in this town, and that are now being used again for goods and services. And it's a junction point. It's a place where things are actually exchanged, for lack of a better term. You got movement from one train to another, people moving, goods moving. So there still needed to be some type of a place where you could rest or wait for your next train. And so all indications are that it went back to this grand hotel. And then after tourism started to decline and the rails, you know, other rail lines started opening, and it wasn't that big juncture that it was, you know, like everything, it started to go into that period of decline.
How far back? Obviously, you have people starting to stay here. It's very well known this was a hospital. Lots of people came through. It's no secret what had happened in this hotel. And obviously, ghosts and paranormal and all that, you know, it was not what it is today as far as how it's viewed or what it is. But there was also, you know, there was more superstition at the time, too, that would be readily and socially acceptable. And talks of ghost stories and just kind of accepted as, well, you know, that's part of life. It is what it is. How far back do the ghost stories go with this hotel after the war, where people started reporting, seeing things and experiencing things there? How far back can you track that, whether it just be legend and a story passed down, or what's the furthest back that you've found?
From my research and from what we've been told through some of the tours that we've had there, it started almost instantaneously after the war. You know, reports of shadow figures, reports of noises, footsteps, moaning, crying, those type of things were reported. There was a report that had carried on through since the Civil War of a guy named Major Richards, who was staying at the hotel when he found out, or staying in the summer kitchen when he found out that his wife had cheated on him. So he ended up killing her and then hanging himself. But the rumors are, before he hung himself, he made a promise that he would haunt the property forever. And all indications are that has come true. There's a lot of paranormal investigators that go in or day tour people that go in and experience some type of, either apparition or paranormal activity or feeling that they associate with this major. They call him the major. And so I think pretty much after the wars when some of those reports and legends really started.
Wow. So it really does go back quite a ways.
It does.
Are there any accounts of people just staying at the hotel and what they experienced in detail? Any stories other than just, yes, people reported ghostly sightings and noises? Are there any specific accounts that you've heard of, maybe even firsthand from people who had stayed there back in the 60s or 70s or anything of that nature?
Not really that I found that have been documented, mostly just through word of mouth. Mm-hmm. A friend of a friend stayed here one time, that sort of thing. But a lot of those accounts are being backed up, if you will, by paranormal investigators who have gone in and experienced similar things. So, for example, one of the reports are that there's a woman who used to be a slave and a servant and a cook in the summer kitchen. And the reports are that she appears as a shadow figure, or if you ask her what she's cooking, she'll say fried chicken. And you see her walking between the two buildings on some instances. And these have been documented by other paranormal investigators. And again, these are stories that have been passed down that we're now getting documentation of.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. How did you become interested in this property? What was it that struck you, obviously, other than being haunted? What was the beginning of the story and your connection with it?
For us and for my team, really, we really try to look for those locations that are historic in nature, that have a really great story, that even if we go in and do a paranormal investigation and we find nothing, we can still put a great story out there that most people would not know about. So, we can go to the larger locations like a Waverly Hills or a Moundsville Penitentiary, but most people know those histories, most people know those stories and those legends. What we like to do is find the smaller locations that, through the paranormal world, that they may have a reputation, but for the general public, most might not know those stories. And for us, the history is the driving force behind what we do. So when we came across the Exchange Hotel, one of our members lives in Virginia, and it was kind of her deal to scope out some locations that we could visit in Virginia. And she found the Exchange Hotel. And, when we started researching it on our own before we even went there, we were just fascinated by the transformation from, hotel to triage hospital, back to hotel, to now a museum. And that's just something that we really felt that we wanted to investigate and get that story out. And then secondary was to find any paranormal activity to back up those claims that have already been put forth.
I see. So when you you first went in there to do an investigation and you set foot, was it the first time you'd been into the building when you went in for an investigation? Let me ask you that first.
It was. So what we do is we actually like to take a day tour before we actually go in for the night. Mm-hmm. So we took a day tour on the Thursday before we did our Saturday investigation. And we spent a lot of time there just kind of getting the lay of the land, if you will, just kind of looking around, spending a couple hours there, trying to process what it looks like and where we would set up our equipment. And then we went in and did the investigation the following Saturday.
So what was it like for you and your team when you went in for the very first time on that day tour, that day trip of wandering into that building? How did it feel for you? What were you experiencing? Was it what you expected? Walk us through that.
Well, I'll kind of step back a little bit and start with the town of Gordonsville. When you start researching these places, you start to kind of picture in your mind what it would look like. And so when we drove through Gordonsville on that Thursday, it was pretty much what we pictured. It's a very quaint little town. There are railroad lines that go through it, and you cross over those. But it really is kind of like stepping back in time. And then when you pull up to the hotel, it looks like a very large three-story house. And so when you kind of step back and realize that this was the Opulent Hotel that we've been researching, it's a pretty surreal feeling to know, okay, we're about ready to go in and kind of step back in time, if you will. So when we went into the hotel itself, it really was for us a step back in history, because like I said, it is set up with that with those displays outlining how it was used as a triage hospital, a lot of Civil War memorabilia, if you will, artifacts. And so you walk through it, again, it's a three-story building, and you walk through it and you really start to feel like you've stepped back in time, stepped back into history. You know, the floors still creak. They're all original hardwood. You know, you see the large rooms, the high ceilings, the large veranda. And then you put yourself in the hotel situation where, okay, this room is, if you're back in the 1850s, this room is massive. But then when you try to squeeze in a surgery table and six recovery cots, it starts to become very small. So when you have to look at it as from both angles, which to us is interesting, and then, you know, starting to couple that with the paranormal stories and the legends that we've been told, you really do start to feel like, yes, there is some heaviness here. There is some residual energy and probably some energy that is willing to interact with you if you go in with the right intentions.
So going in for then the investigation, how did you prepare? What were your plans for the investigation that you and your team did to go in and check out this building?
Well, let me step back one and go back to the day tour for just 1 second.
Yeah.
You know, as I told you, there's a summer kitchen, and that sits on the outside of the main building, the main hotel. So when you walk into that summer kitchen, it's set up like a small tavern area at the first level. So you've got a little fireplace and such, and that's where the cooking would be done. And then you go upstairs, and there's two bedrooms, which is where the servants would sleep. And so the reports there in that house is that that was where Major Richards, as I spoke about before, found out that his wife was cheating. He killed her, and then he hung himself in a tree outside. So the reports are that when you go up to one of the rooms upstairs, there's a heaviness that the major the spirit of the major does not like women. And my team is all female. So there was three of us that had walked in there. Again, this is on the day tour. There are three of us that had walked in there, and we always carry a voice recorder with us during those day tours. And one of my team members had said, remind me why she doesn't go into this room, meaning the proprietor. Why doesn't she go into this room? And I say, she doesn't like this room. It creeps her out. And when we went back and listened to that recording, you hear a male behind us laughing, kind of like an evil hee-hee-hee-hee-hee laugh. And so for us, we listened to it that night. For us, it really started our investigation out in an excited manner, because we had already caught an EVP, and that was just during the day tour. So during that day tour, we also set up, you know, a look and scout out where we're going to set up our cameras, where we're going to set up our laser grids, our trigger items and such. So when we went back on Saturday, we really had in our minds where we wanted cameras placed, where we wanted our trigger items, what type of EVP session questions we were going to ask, and you know, some different things that we were going to try in order to communicate with the spirits that we felt were still there.
That's really amazing, where you already had that interaction with that mm-hmm. male figure, with that story that's behind it of what had happened there. What's interesting to me is the fact that you have all those, that death in that building, and there's this one that really stands out that happened after the fact, or after the war, that is, you know, such a big point of this building. And we'll talk more about that in a moment, and more of what was found. But do you think that in this building, just because of all the death and all of the sadness and everything that had occurred there during the war, that lent it to be not such a positive place, that there was already such a strong emotion in there that could also pull the living down with it, essentially into a depressive state, into doing irrational things? I'm not saying that because of all the people that died there, that this man then, after he found out about his wife was cheating on him, that he killed himself. But do you think that that plays a role in anything when it comes to the paranormal?
You know, it may to some extent, you know, for the major, and I'm just speaking just hypothetically, yeah. You know, for the major, he's already gone through a war. He's already seen death. And so I would imagine that at that point, death is not something that's very scary to you anymore. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's the reason why, you know, he thought he had something happy in his wife. And when he found out she was cheating on him, you know, death is just a natural part of life now for this guy. He's seen it. He's lived it. He's been immersed in it for several years. So it was nothing for him to kill himself, to kill her and then kill himself.
Yeah.
And again, that's just me speaking hypothetically. So whether or not the place had an impact on him, it may have, but I also feel it was also the times that he had lived in.
Sure.
And so I would think maybe that would be a driving factor more so than any residual spirits that have been in the house.
Okay.
Or the hotel.
Yeah. That wraps up part one of our interview with Christy Summer of Soul Sisters Paranormal about the Haunted Exchange Hotel. To hear part two of our interview, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks to become a supporter and get access to part two of this interview and all of our interviews, as well as advanced access to our episodes months before they are released to the public. In part two, we're going to ask, what was the ghost child, or who was the ghost child that Christy and her team found inside the hotel? What kind of trigger items were used to try and entice the spirits to come forward? Does an invite need to be presented to spirits in order for them to use a trigger item, or can it be done without prompting? What is the thought process when leaving out food or drink for a ghost if they know they can't consume it on the other side? Is a spirit more likely to move on if they know that their story has been told? And is it ever the role of the living to help the dead cross over? We're going to discuss all that and more in part two of our interview. Again, to hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. Visit patreon.com/thegravetalks. To become a Gravekeeper, or go to our website, thegravetalks.com, and follow the links. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.